Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
McKeever Conwell, better known as Mac Conwell, founder and managing partner of Rare Breed Ventures.
Mac, thanks so much for making time to join us on the Ivy Podcast today, right after the July 4th holiday, first thing after the much needed time off. Before we jump right into, you know, talk about Rare Breed Ventures, which I'm very excited to talk to you about, give us a thumbnail version of your career prior to that.
Thumbnail version. So software engineer by trade, studied computer science. I was a government contractor supporting the DOD with a top secret clearance. Went on to have two startups. One was an exit, one not so much. Worked for the investment arm of the state of Maryland for 4 years, where I did seed investments and launched a pre-seed fund specifically for underrepresented founders, and now currently raising a fund of my own.
Wow, that's a super exciting career, which, you know, a lot of that ties together as well in terms of what you're currently doing, which, you know, traditionally for me, you know, you've mentioned you had multiple startups yourself, and I can relate to that experience where I had, you know, successfully failed a lot of them with a decent outcome, luckily with just one. But using that experience and paying it forward, in a sense, operating in either angel investing or venture capital side, it makes sense. I think it, you know, it's relatable on so many levels. So tell us a little bit more about Rare Breed Ventures. You've mentioned you had worked for other organizations where you did focus on overlooked, underrepresented founders. Tell us a little bit more about kind of your thesis, your vision here.
Yeah, so at Rare Breed, we primarily invest in companies outside the major tech hubs, outside of Silicon Valley, New York, and Massachusetts, doing pre-seed to seed investments. With a focus really around two things, considering we are a industry agnostic fund. The only industry we don't invest in exclusively is life sciences. But for everything else, what we really look for is if it's a software or tech-enabled company, we like to see a clearly repeatable or unique customer acquisition strategy. Don't have to have a lot of customers, but kind of need to know how you get your customers. And then we also like physical products, typically in consumer markets that have lacked innovation for 10 or more years. So that's the way we think about the world of venture and where the opportunities are.
That's very, very unique. And, you know, definitely a differentiation factor, especially when you talk about the kind of the geographical allocation. So outside of Metro Tech Hubs, what are the specific areas that you have had success in terms of finding very unique deals?
I mean, I've found unique deals everywhere, you know, from Washington, D.C. to Alabama to St. Louis to Arizona, Nevada, like, you know, Kentucky. Found a really cool company in Kentucky. So Tennessee, you know, looking at a company right now in Memphis, Tennessee, that, you know, there's a good chance we'll pull the trigger on. So, you know, you can find amazing, talented entrepreneurs anywhere. You just have to take the time to really find them.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, that's definitely the areas that you don't hear in the news or in the media quite often, which I would definitely imagine there is a great pool of that, you know, the founders that are building really cool stuff that's oftentimes just overlooked, in the sense that it's high concentration in very, you know, the tech hubs, so to say. So in terms of your approach and really being able to identify some of these very unique talent when it comes to entrepreneurs and founders building very innovative category defining products, what are some of the, I guess, you know, processes or the techniques that really help you stay ahead of the competition and be able to almost be that kind of that NBA scout looking in somewhere remote place in Africa where you discover the next, you know, Giannis? So tell us a little bit more about this.
So I think that's the key right there. It's every VC's has a different approach to deal sourcing, right? And having differentiated deal flow is the big thing that a lot of VCs try to hang their hats on, but a lot of it just has to do with their networks. For me, when I was working at the state of Maryland, my job was to find every Black founder of a tech company I could for the specific pre-seed fund we were creating. And so I spent my time going everywhere. I went to every small business meeting. I went to every organization, every economic development corp, everywhere. And what I learned was business owners know business owners. And so now that I'm running my own fund and having a more national and even somewhat international focus, still doing the same thing. It's, you know, speaking at all the accelerators and incubators, especially the off the beaten path ones, being accessible, looking at DMs and cold emails, willing to talk at, you know, Chamber of Commerce events and Birmingham, Alabama, right? So for me, it's really looking everywhere and being as accessible as I can. And then also taking the brand building approach. We saw this with Arlen Hamilton as she was building Backstage. By having the brand and presence, it made entrepreneurs want her on their cap table. So we're doing something similar at Rare Breed where, you know, with my Twitter presence, I now have, you know, entrepreneurs who are reaching out to me with very well-established companies who are looking for me to be on their cap table just because they like what Rare Breed is about. And so we have advantages of getting deals from all over the place.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, as an angel investor, I can definitely relate to that unique, I guess, that unfair advantage as an investor to be able to build that relationship with the founders and showcase that, you know, at the end of the day, building a great deal flow is one thing, but having access is completely different spectrum in terms of, especially when you're competing with, you know, well-established funds. I think having that, you know, unique value proposition for the founders actually wanting you to be on their cap table, to have that, you know, seat at the board. I think that's, you know, that's how you compete in a today's market with such a, you know, overabundance of capital, I guess, availability. I think that's very unique. So to shift gears a little bit on you, I spent a lot of time talking to other VCs and, you know, other GPs that are members of different funds. And it's always fascinating to me to talk about the very first fund that they were raising, because it really reminds me of, and I don't see much difference when I was fundraising for a lot of my startups as an entrepreneur. So when you first set out and you said, this is my passion, this is what I'm going to do, fund one, tell us a little bit more about that very initial experience. How did you go about that? And what were some of the biggest challenges that you had encountered, you know, that you didn't really foresee? Because I would imagine it was a, you know, maybe, you know, very extensive period of many presentations and lots of feedback and a lot of people wanting you to change your deck and so forth. Just share some experience from that perspective.
So the raising of a fund is one difficulty in itself, right? But deciding to do a fund, you know, starting there, you know, working for the state of Maryland, doing this pre-seed fund and still finding amazing entrepreneurs I couldn't support, you know, really was what propelled me to say, I need to do this somehow. The problem was I'm not personally independently wealthy. And so, you know, not having the funds to actually raise a fund, because like to raise a fund, one, you got to have 1% of the fund amount yourself. And then you got to be able to pay for all the travel and things that coincide with raising a fund, meeting your LPs and such. But got lucky enough that, you know, when I decided I was going to do this, it was during the pandemic. So everybody's doing everything from Zoom calls, so I don't have to travel. I had a little bit of a nest egg to try and survive through. But I think the biggest thing that popped up was the same issue I had as a founder, which I realized I didn't have a network. So like as a founder, I didn't have a network of VCs or even just operators I could talk to and go to for advice and mentors and advisors, and I had to build that up. And so I figured that network was good enough to raise a fund. And then I realized I didn't have a network of LPs. Like those are two different things. And so trying to figure that out was around the same time I started being more active on Twitter. And so when I started thinking about raising this fund last June, I had 2,500 followers. I started tweeting more often. And as I saw my following grow, I started to notice other VCs were following me. So I just started having as many meetings as I could because I needed to get as much advice and needed to grow my network more. And as I did that, some number of folks started committing to the fund. And I was like, oh, this is a strategy. And so from like the middle of June last year to the middle of September last year, I had over 1,100 meetings. Wow. So from then till now, it's been almost a year, I've had close to 45, maybe 5,000 meetings, right? And that's gotten me to the point where I've, you know, raised about 80% of the funds so far. So the not having a network and figuring out how to gain one was, I wasn't expecting, but Twitter came through and it worked out really well for me.
Wow, really? That's, those are some astounding numbers in terms of the number of meetings in the thousands. That's wow, that's incredible. And you know, in a sense, you've mentioned that the power of a network at the end of the day, it's also kind of, I relate to that on so many levels. That's the reason I started my podcast, is because of that specific reason, because ability to connect with like-minded folks or people from different industries. I think it's, you know, I recommend that to all of either startups that I invest in or the people that I partner with to do any business with. At the end of the day, it's not only from the fundraising perspective, but if you're trying to acquire customers and do whatever the case may be, I think that's super smart. So that's very interesting. Wow, thousands of meetings. How long did that process overall take, timeline-wise, when you first set out from your first meeting to when you actually closed the fund one?
We're still in the process of raising fund one, so don't want to act like we've closed it yet. We're getting there. So I started soft circling. I started meeting people in like mid-June. I started soft circling money in July, and I officially launched the fund in September. So from September 2020 till now, we're in July of 2021. I've gotten commitments for 8 million of the 10 for the 10, that's the goal. So, you know, we're still in it. People tell me I'm moving quickly through it. It doesn't feel quickly because this is terms of months and years. But it has been a process. In full disclosure, I can publicly talk about my fundraise and everything. We're raising under 506C, so I'm allowed to publicly solicit for anybody listening. But yeah, so it's still an ongoing process. We plan, if nothing else, we plan to close the fund at the end of the year. So that would be a little longer than a year timeline, moving closer to a year and a half. If we're lucky, we may close it before the end of the summer. Fingers crossed.
Yeah, that definitely seems like an accelerated timeline in terms of, as you compare to the number of meetings that are actually happening. It seems like a multi-year endeavor of, you know, 1,000+ meetings. That's incredible. What were some of the, I guess, rejection points that really surprised you during that period? That obviously when we go through fundraising, we try to prepare as much as we can for as many rejection or counter arguments or whatever the case may be. What were some of the areas that you were like, oh, wow, I did not expect that?
I had one institution pass on me because they said, they thought I was a good investor, but they said to build a large stage firm and grow your AUM over time, you really need to be something special. They're like, we don't know if you're that special person. We know you're good at this, but we don't know if you're special at this. I was like, what does that even mean? like, how am I supposed to even, like, what am I supposed to do with that? You know, things like that have come up. But really, as a first-time fund manager, what I figured out was, without having extensive track record, then people are going to be betting on you and your strategy more than anything else, right? So like most funds, if they have a really extensive due diligence process, I'll probably never pass that, right? I'm not going to check off all the marks. Like it's just not going to happen. But if you're somebody looking for differentiated deal flow, looking for a unique perspective, or just really like what I'm about and want to back me, then that's probably the majority of my LPs. And it just reminded me of being an entrepreneur, right? When you're raising a pre-seed or seed round, it's essentially what it is. So I feel like, you know, a seed entrepreneur trying to raise their first round of funding.
Right, absolutely. At the end of the day, it's no different than as a as a founder of a startup where, with no track record, I've been there myself, where, you know, they ask about your background, what have you done that's very similar to like this before, and I didn't have anything to show. And at the end of the day, it was really an investment into you as the founder, or as the, I guess, the person in charge, investing into your character and, you know, who you are. At the end of the day, I think that makes perfect sense. So when, you know, when you work with your founders, with the companies that you decide to invest in or not, tell us a little bit more about that very initial period, the very first set of meetings when you're just meeting the founder for the very first time. What are some of the areas that really you pay attention to that really make you think, okay, this has legs, this is something that I'm willing to invest in further time into kind of getting to know that person better?
Yeah, so, you know, the first initial means is really getting you to understand what was the driving force behind you coming up with this idea, like why was this so important to you, getting a sense of the size of the market, and understanding the way that you really think about customer acquisition and how you've gone about growth so far. Growth is always a great equalizer for companies, right? The faster you're growing, the easier it is to raise money, right? The more we'll be able to look into. And then also, you know, I start getting to really pay attention to inner team dynamics, right? Like poor team dynamics will kill a company faster than anything else. So, you know, noticing the way the team interacts, the way the founders interact, seeing how, if they talk over each other, if they disagree with each other, you know, are there are little arguments happening that may seem like something small in the moment, but could be a signal of something larger. So always trying to look for things like that. And really trying to understand, you know, how much their customers truly love the product, right? Getting a chance to understand who their customers are, why their customers are using it, trying to understand how well they know their customers. For me, I'm really big on customer acquisition. So like a bunch of what we do has to, and what we think through, what we talk through has to do around those kinds of things.
Right. No, that's very, you know, absolutely, in a sense that getting to know, especially from a team dynamics perspective, because it's a long-term relationship at the end of the day for both sides, not even just with the founders between each other, but with you as an investor being tied at the hip with that team for the next 10 years or so. I think you got to be able to have that very open, very transparent relationship with each other. So that definitely really, you know, relates on so many levels. What are some of your most favorite questions, that your go-to questions, that if you do have those when you meet the founders, or if you're unsure, that those type of questions really help you uncover some of the additional information?
So I really like to ask founders questions like, why do you think this would fail? Like what would have to happen for this to not work out, right? And to see, because it really gives you a lens into the way founders are critically thinking about what they're building, and also to see how honest they are with themselves, right? Like with some companies, like it's really clear what the issues are and why this could fail, right? Like flat out, like, are you going to be honest about it, or are you going to try and, you know, hem and haw around the issue? So I love doing that. I love asking founders, why do they want Rare Breed to be an investor, right? Like, is it just the money? Is it more than the money? Like what is it? Questions that founders aren't always thinking about. I really love to ask them about, what was your experience with your first customer? You know, what happened? Did they like it? Did they not like it? What did you learn? What didn't you learn? Yeah, so those are like three of the more unique questions I like to ask.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, those are great questions. And it's always fascinating to me to talk about this particular area, because every VC, every investor has their own go-to questions. So I'm fascinated by that. And if I was to kind of summarize all of that, for me, the biggest takeaway and lesson learned through this kind of the mini angel investing journey that I've been on is being a friend to a founder versus being a parent. In a sense, as a friend, would I ask that question to you? Or, you know, I have small children and I have to always put that frame of thought when I talk to the founders, in a sense, because you want to get out of their way. You want them to do their thing and just being there. Because when the whole value add investor framework comes about, I view that it's on the founder, it's on the entrepreneur to derive that value out of me versus me pushing that onto you based on my experience of what I think is right, which probably is not the right, you know, dynamic at the end of the day. So that's very interesting. What are some of the, and I realize it's a loaded question, that a lot of parts that kind of comprise that, but if you were to point out one thing that it's a deal breaker for you, what would that be and why is that?
One thing that's a deal breaker. A founder who's acting like a jerk during the fundraising process, right? Because every time I make an investment, I have to think to myself, is this somebody worth losing sleep over? Like every company you invest in, at some point, you're going to lose some sleep over. There's going to be some ups and downs. There's going to be issues. You need to be there. This is a partnership. This is like a marriage. So is this somebody that I want to work with? Right? So, you know, being super aggressive, being combative, starting arguments on a regular basis, it's going to turn me off right away. Also, lying is probably the easiest way to kill a deal. You know, I put a tweet out about this the other day about, you know, when you put advisors on your deck, make sure you ask them if it's okay to put their picture on your deck, right? If I call up one of those advisors and they don't know who you are, there goes that. Like, that is done, right? So, you know, those are easy ways to kill a deal.
Right, right. No, absolutely. Do you see a lot of that? Do you see that as a trend, or proportionately with the good deals versus those that's kind of deal breakers for you? Is that frequent?
I wouldn't say it's frequent, but it happens enough that you know, it's still something you always got to check, right? So it's not a regular thing, but it happens. Like, you know, once every other month, I might get one of those and be like, can't do this.
Yeah, the reason I asked that is because if it was worthy of a tweet, then I guess it's something that did happen more than once. And that's very interesting, I guess, putting myself in the shoes of the founders from like very early days. It's one thing being desperate and I guess trying to go, you know, find by all means necessary to get the attention, to get the deal going, but at the same time, misrepresenting something that could really get you in trouble in such a small space. It's such a small, you know, network that's, you know, the word gets out and things like that usually don't work out. What are some of the trends that you personally very excited about, aside from the areas where you invest in? What are you tinkering with nights and weekends? What are some of the things that keep you up at night? They're like, wow, this is so cool. This is super exciting. That's the next big thing.
So really interested in, you know, the crypto and NFT space, you know, for all the investments that have happened in crypto and blockchain, it's still in this infancy, right? Same thing for virtual reality and mixed reality. These are industries that are still in their infancy. There's still a lot of room for innovation. Oddly enough, beauty and hair. I'm really excited about the beauty and hair space. We've made 4 investments in that space so far, and we'll probably make, you know, several more. So really thinking through the future of beauty, the future of hair. Great examples, a company out of St. Louis, Rebundle. They make plant-based biodegradable braiding hair. So, you know, plant-based synthetic hair, right? Really cool stuff. And, you know, I'm really excited about that space. I'm really excited about the future of esports. The future of esports. And this is a space that's growing right now, and it's going to be interesting to see. But the idea that anything can be an asset, and, you know, how blockchain can allow you to invest in any asset, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're seeing these platforms where people can invest in collectible cars, collectible watches, paintings. You're going to start to see stuff like athletes, right? Especially now with the ruling coming down where college athletes can make money off of their name and likenesses. You know, it's not going to be far too long before somebody's like, hey, you can now make an investment in this high school kid or this college kid, you know, as they progress through their career. You know, a lot of interesting stuff happening in that space. So, you know, they're not like new trends that nobody else is paying attention to, but those are the things that I'm really interested in.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, absolutely. You definitely shocked me with the personal beauty and the hair side. That was a curveball. It's definitely interesting. I wanna learn a little bit more, maybe outside of this forum, what are the different things that you really see in there. But when it comes to different trends, I think that's very exciting in terms of just, you know, looking at everything that we've been seeing through pandemic and coming out of that, from just overall cryptocurrency blockchain perspective. I think the NFT really was on the rise with the whole NCAA ruling. I think you're right on point in terms of being able to invest into some of the prospects that we're seeing in sports. That's very exciting. What areas on the contrary side, when you see a certain space that you're like, no way, I'm staying out of this. What are some of the areas that you're very cautious that you will not entertain?
So I'm not a big fan on social networks, just because that industry, like, it's always oversaturated. It's so hard to tell, you know, what's going to be a breakout until it is. And so really for me, it's a lot of the oversaturated markets. Social networks. I used to say dating. I did actually invest in a dating app, so like I can't say that anymore, but not a big fan of that space. In the hair and beauty space, everybody's talking about the different consumable companies. So, you know, the different oils and creams. There's a million of those. Staying away. It's not what I'm interested in. I'm interested in more of the like physical tools as opposed to the creams and consumables.
Things
like I've seen a bunch of times. So like if you got an app that's like help you find the best happening club in, you know, your local area, out on that. There's a million of those. They don't work, right? They never make it anywhere. And so yeah, I think for me it's like the business models and companies I've seen time and time and time again not be able to break through. Which I also know is a terrible bias, because eventually there's always going to be one that makes it. Like there's always one that makes it. I just don't know if I'm the one to select that one.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, absolutely. That's, interesting dynamics when it comes to some of the areas that, you know, have a lot longer, traction to get that flywheel going. I think from the social networking perspective, it's a unique perspective. Dating apps, it's, you know, unless it's something very niche-y, I guess it's definitely very difficult to get that off the ground, or very resource intensive, you know, as with a lot of other like hardware, D2C e-commerce products. I've seen, you know, those are very capital intensive in terms of being able to get to the right audience. Mac, in terms of you staying, you know, ahead of the curve, self-educating, what's your content diet is looking like these days? What are some of the sources that you consume on a daily basis that really help you, you know, look at the different trends, look at the different things that, you know, from self-education perspective, with so much information being available out there, I'm always fascinated at some of the techniques that people use to be, you know, very selective when it comes to exposing your mind to the right information.
So, you know, Twitter is a great resource. I follow a lot of the tech journalists. And so having a list of them and being able to see all the news coming out, at Bloomberg, like, you know, you got to look at public, you got to be interested in public and private, you know, we're in the funding business. I do the TechCrunch, the Venture Beats, the CNNs, and then I do a lot of podcasts. You know, I do a lot of podcasts. Origin Podcast is amazing. 20 Minute VC. Why can't I? Full Ratchet. I love the Full Ratchet. You know, those guys in Chicago are amazing. So, you know, a lot of podcasts. And then generally speaking, I do a lot of audiobooks. Mm-hmm. So I try to consume, 50 audiobooks a year. In the pandemic, that's been a little harder because I usually listen to them during my commutes. Audiobooks. I'm real big on mostly nonfiction, you know, a lot of business books, a lot of biographies. So that's the type of content I'm taking in.
So you couldn't have set me up with the last question I always ask is, what are you currently reading or listening, I guess, in this case? And What is one book that you always recommend to others, and why is that?
So one book I would recommend to everybody out there. So it's two books, really. I'm gonna recommend two books because they're my two heroes. The first one is called The Militant Moderator or Mediator. The Militant Mediator is a book about Whitney Young, who is a famous civil rights activist who was the gentleman who people tout as bringing the most money into the civil rights movement. So The Militant Mediator about Whitney Young, and then Why Should White Guys Have All the Fun, which is the autobiography of Reginald F. Lewis, who was a Black man who became a billionaire running a private equity fund originally from East Baltimore, so from my hometown. So my goal in life is to be some combination of those two gentlemen. The book I'm reading now or listening to now is actually a nonfiction book, and I'm picking up my Audible so I get the title right. Children of Virtue and Vengeance. It's the second book in a series of basically, it's a series that's placed in Africa where these tribes, certain tribes have magical powers. And so what does it look like in a world where these individuals have these magical powers, but they're vilified for being magicians and going through like this civil war and like this tug in society. A really interesting series of books, recommended to everybody out there. So,
well, that's super cool, and I'm definitely gonna add those to the long list of my book recommendations. And for our listeners, we'll make those titles available in the show notes. One that I want to add to what you were just talking about is I just finished it. It's called the Mental Toughness Handbook. By Damon Zaharieh, if I believe I'm pronouncing the last name right. But it's you know, the whole mental health for me has been very interesting to study. So there's just one that I finished recently. Matt, can't thank you enough for your time today. Very short and insightful conversation. You were very generous with your advice, with some of the, you know, the strategies that you deploy on a day-to-day basis. What I love doing with all of the guests on Ivy Podcast is doing another episode in about a year and revisit the conversation from a year ago to see how much have changed, transpired, and everything that we've talked about actually still makes sense. So I'm definitely looking forward to doing that with you as well.
I'm looking forward to that too. Hopefully I'll be in a much better place in terms of fundraising and everything next time around.
I'm sure you will. Thanks so much, man.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.